from KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. The primary election is tomorrow, and there are five state constitutional amendments on the ballot. Among these are the controversial right to farm amendment and the transportation tax amendment. There are also some primaries on the ballot that could help Republicans gain back a veto-proof majority in the Missouri House. And here locally, there are some interesting races and issues. And today on Intersection, we'll be discussing what you'll be seeing on the ballot tomorrow and talk about what you need to know before you go to vote. In studio today, Rudy Keller is a state government and politics reporter with the Columbia Tribune. Rudy?
Hello, Ryan. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Scott Swofford is the city editor for the Columbia Missourian, and he's a professor at the MU School of Journalism. Scott, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Ryan. Thanks for asking me to be here.
Yeah, great. And David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press working at the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. David, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
All right. And for you in our audience, do you have any questions about what's on the ballot tomorrow? Let us know by giving us a call, 573-882-8925, or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at IntersectKBIA. So as I mentioned there in the intro, we've got five statewide ballot issues, starting with Amendment 1. Why don't we start there? Because that's one that's gotten a lot of attention, really, over the past few months, the so-called right to farm. First off, I guess, what is that, the right to farm? David?
Well, it's very short. It says, shall the right to engage in farming and ranching be forever guaranteed in this state? What does that mean? Well, that's where the debate starts, right? Well, no one knows what it means, right? And So that's why you have a lot of ads going on each side trying to tell people what it might mean.
Right. And who are those ads coming from on each side? Like, who's opposed, who's for it?
Well, we can tell. Generally speaking, the agricultural industry in the state, from the pork producers to the soybean and corn associations, the Farm Bureau, they're footing a lot of those ads that you're seeing for it. Most of the ads against it are coming from the Humane Society of the United States. And if readers are unfamiliar with who they are the group that helped bankroll the puppy mill ballot measure in 2010.
Right. And that's not necessarily a coincidence, right? I mean, this right to farm, some people have pointed to that as one of the reasons this is something we're going to see on the ballot this year.
There is a direct connection. While this was being talked about vaguely before that ballot measure gave it a boost. And the agricultural industry responded to the ballot measure on dog breeding with this effort to say, we don't want anything else that might mess with what we want to do here. For what it's worth, one other state beat us to the punch. North Dakota has already adopted a right to farm in its constitution. And contrary to all the hyperbole surrounding the issue, nothing's happened there yet with it. There hasn't been a court case either citing it or challenging it as it relates to any state laws there yet.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of mixed feelings among people when you go out and talk to voters about this right to farm amendment. I was talking with a Republican candidate, Betsy Phillips, who we might talk about in the 47th district, and she says she's reluctantly voting for it but she's suspicious because of the big players on both sides. And the puppy mill proposition from a few years ago had several things that are having a long-lasting impact on the state. One is things like this constitutional amendment. The other is that other initiatives are being planned that would otherwise be statutory initiatives as constitutional amendments. The people who want to legalize marijuana, after watching the puppy mill proposition be changed by the legislature significantly, have decided that when they push an initiative petition, they're going to put their legalization of marijuana into the Constitution, because that means lawmakers can't overturn it with a simple vote. They would have to go back to voters to do that. So it's an interesting dynamic that the Humane Society created. The things that the farmers are worried about, the farm groups are worried about that might come along, are something like a rule they have in California that says that chickens that are laying eggs have to have a certain amount of space so that they can turn around in their cage, because that's a more humane way to raise, to treat chickens who are creating eggs. Our attorney general is suing the state of California because that regulation says that no eggs can be imported into California that are not raised under those conditions.
Right. And so, as you said earlier, Dave, we don't really know for sure what the impact might be. I mean, we had the show a couple weeks ago talking about CAFOs in the state, and that's one thing a lot of people have concerns about is how, if this was approved, how that may affect an operation like that. And I guess if it's not, maybe it's not as clear if it really makes
right.
a difference.
Well, some of the opponents would suggest that if this were approved and a CAFO wanted to challenge a regulation about how much of a buffer space it had to have around its farming operation, that they could go to the state constitution and say that this regulation or this state law conflicts with our constitutional right to farm. Who knows?
Right.
That would be a case of first impression in the court.
Right. As you said, North Dakota, we don't have a use case yet for this
right.
kind of thing.
And the deal in North Dakota didn't attract near the attention that this one has in Missouri. It was very low budget. The opponents spent hardly any money. And so it was just an under-the-radar thing. And so Missouri really stands as the first test sort of nationally about, does this pass? And if so, what does it mean?
Mm-hmm. Does it look likely, from what we can tell, that other states will be interested or are watching this?
Well, it's been proposed in other states. It came close to passing and getting on the ballot in Oklahoma this past year. Indiana has passed something similar to it. It's not in the Constitution. It's just a statutory law. But, yeah, I think if it passes in Missouri, and depending on how it's carried out, other Midwestern agriculture states may pursue it.
And conversely, I know that the Humane Society of the United States was considering whether or not to put any significant money into this campaign until they were wondering about the polling, whether it would be a successful effort to oppose it. There is a poll that's come out that I'm not sure how much credence I would put in it, but it's leading 48-40, and so the Humane Society may have decided to put their money in as a test case to see how are Missouri voters, can they be persuaded one way or the other, and if they prevail, and then we may see some more puppy mill like measures coming from them.
Do you know what the margin of error was on that poll? Could be a dead heat, depending on the margin.
Yeah,
of
error. That's true. It says about 3%. So it was 48-40 in the poll. So.
Yeah, okay. Sure. Well, and I guess, yeah, it's tough on these primary ballot issues, right, because there's not a whole lot of polling that happens on
these. Yeah, these are ballot amendments, Amendment 1 and then Amendment 7, which is the 3/4-cent sales tax for transportation purposes, seem to be the things that will drive voters to the polls statewide. And they're the things that are having there's no United States Senate race this year. There's an auditor's race, but there's no primaries, and there's not even a Democratic candidate on the auditor's ballot. So other than a Democratic primary in St. Louis County regarding their St. Louis executive, the ballot measures are the big thing that are going to be driving voters to the polls, other than whatever local county race or legislative race that is involved in their area.
Is there any other measure? I mean, I guess your guys' opinions on if you think this may pass or any other indications you've had other than polls. I'm not asking you to put on your soothsayer hats, but what are your feelings about something like this, an issue like this, going to Missourians?
Well, traditionally, I would say Missouri being an agricultural state, and we've seen that rural interests on many of these types of measures have prevailed over the years. But so going into this, I thought this is going to be a slam dunk. Amendment 1 is going to pass easily. But you've seen, even within the agricultural community, there seems to be a schism. Is this to protect the rights of family farmers, or is this to protect the rights of corporate farmers or the ability of corporate farmers to gain even more inroads into Missouri? And so I think that kind of makes it a toss-up.
And there aren't a lot of votes in the rural areas. The big, like I said, there's going to be a big turnout in St. Louis County among Democrats. One of the opponents of Amendment 1 pointed out there are 200,000 Humane Society United States members in the state of Missouri. So in a low turnout, low interest election, it's very difficult to say how this is going to turn out.
I need to take a moment to remind our listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner. The primary election is tomorrow, and there are 5 state constitutional amendments on the ballot, in addition to the regular races for nominations and other local issues. Today on Intersection, we're discussing with journalists what you'll be seeing on the ballot tomorrow and talking about what you need to know before you vote. Joining us in studio, Rudy Keller is a state government and politics reporter with the Columbia Tribune. Scott Swofford is the city editor of the Columbia Missourian and the professor at the MU School of Journalism. And David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press working at the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. For you and our audience, what do you think about the proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot tomorrow? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Rudy, you were talking about the fact that, you know, sometimes these ballot issues can drive out voters. Why did the governor, from what we can tell, why did the governor decide to put these amendments on this ballot instead of the November ballot? And that might be a big question. But. Well,
governors have a lot of leeway when these constitutional amendments are proposed. They go on the November ballot of an even-numbered year unless the governor selects an earlier election. And most of these were passed in this last legislative session, so that left August primary or November. I think that Governor Nixon put, for example, the right to farm. He put the Amendment 5, which is deals with gun rights and the scrutiny that courts give to gun regulations. I think he put those on the ballot because those are measures that will tend to draw out a more conservative electorate. Democrats have fewer than one-third of the legislative seats, and their party is making a significant effort, Attorney General Koster and Senator Claire McCaskill, to win back some of those seats that they've lost over the last 30 years. So if you can keep the conservative voters, the things that drive them to the polls in August instead of November, you might have a chance in a few of the legislative races that you otherwise might lose. The Amendment 7, the governor has announced his opposition to it, but at the same time, it's going on a low turnout election. So the ballot measures such as this tend to draw their supporters more vigorously to the polls than the opponents. So,
thing about Amendment 7, and yeah, that might be a mystery. Why do you put it here versus there? But the one thing it did do was shorten the campaign time period. When he put it on August, the Department of Transportation didn't have a project list yet, and they weren't going to have a project list until the fall. So they had to scramble to pull one together before the August primaries, and it really gave less time for the supporters to put together their campaign. Now, of course, they've still managed to pour in more than $4 million, and we're seeing their ads. But it did just sort of shorten the time period they had to get organized for it.
Yeah, and this is probably a good time to start talking about Amendment 7. It's a 3/4-cent sales tax, for those in our audience that don't know. 3/4-cent sales tax that would fund transportation projects for the next 10 years, or starting in 2015, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, I guess maybe a little bit more about that. It's going to generate hundreds of millions of dollars each year and go toward, as you were talking about, that established a project list both statewide and in these local projects as well, right?
So the cost estimate is $5.4 billion mm-hmm. over 10 years, I should say, up to about $6 billion. There's a little flexibility in who thinks it's going to raise how much. The Transportation Department has put together a project list of over 800 items. The most recognizable one to people would probably be the widening of Interstate 70 to 3 lanes all the way across Missouri between Kansas City and St. Louis. But there's something in almost every neck of the woods. And it's not just for roads and bridges. There's something for, you know, bus routes between Columbia and Jeff City, for example, and sidewalks on city streets. You name it, there's something in there for almost everyone.
Yeah, and they made sure at the Department of Transportation at the Highway Commission meeting that there was. They talked over the list at one meeting and realized that there was a public transit project for 113 counties in the city of St. Louis. Well, there are 114 counties in Missouri plus the city of St. Louis. Ray County was left off, but by the time that meeting was over, they'd come up with money for a public transit project in Ray County. So mm-hmm. they were able to announce that they had a transit project in every county in the state.
But this has also generated a lot of buzz, a lot of controversy, especially a lot of opposition to it. What are some of the reasons for that?
Well, Scott? It's the classic debate over whether sales tax is regressive, whether it's a fair way to raise money for things like this, where you also have the choice of whether to rely on user fees, such as higher fuel taxes or toll roads, which have never gone anywhere in Missouri. So the opponents have said, well, gee whiz, the legislature just passed a huge tax cut that really benefited higher-income people and businesses much more than it did lower-income people. And now they're turning around and asking everybody, including those on the lower-income scale of the spectrum, to pay for roads that they may not even use them all that much. So it's that classic debate, regressive sales tax versus something that taxes users, particularly the trucking industry, which, you know, this amendment not only would establish a 3/4 cent sales tax that everybody would pay, it is worth noting that it would exempt groceries, gasoline, and prescription medicine. But it also prohibits the state from raising fuel taxes or from establishing toll roads during the 10 years that it would be in effect. So, yeah, it's just that classic debate. So, once again, we're deciding, is sales tax a fair way to raise money for something like this?
Well, it would mark a historical shift in how Missouri funds its roads. Missouri's been raising revenues for roads for about 90 years, and the fuel tax has been around that long. And most all of the money we've gotten for our roads has come from taxes on drivers. I mean, you pay fuel taxes, you pay vehicle licensing fees, you pay vehicle sales tax, and that is given to the roads. But there's not ever been a general revenue tax, and this sales tax is a tax on almost everything that you buy. And the argument for that is simply that times are changing and everyone benefits from a transportation system, even if you don't drive on it, right? That the goods you buy at the store came from a truck over the road. And really, it's the most stable way to raise money because fuel tax revenues have been flat or declining as people drive less, as cars get more fuel efficient.
I need to take a moment to remind our audience this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner. The primary election is tomorrow, and there are 5 state constitutional amendments on the ballot in addition to the regular races for and nominations and other local issues. Today on Intersection, we're discussing with journalists what you'll be seeing on the ballot tomorrow and talking about what you need to know before you vote. Joining us in studio, Rudy Kellers, a state government and politics reporter with the Columbia Tribune, Scott Swaffords, the city editor of the Columbia Missourian and a professor at the MU School of Journalism, and David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press working at the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. What issues or races would you like to hear more about? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at InterSectKBIA. We'd like to remind you can watch Intersection is streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at KBIA.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to KBIA.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at KBIA.org. And we actually do have a caller right now, Marty from Columbia. Marty, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Thanks for calling today.
Okay. I've got 3 real quick comments concerning 3 different issues. But the one that, you know, the U.S. Constitution's only had 27 amendments in all these years, and the Missouri Constitution's had over 100 amendments. Why are these being put into this form as amendments to our Constitution? Because it locks things in. I think the gentleman just said that if we go with this sales tax for the fuel, for the roads and everything, we won't be able to come up with any other, we won't be able to use any other means of raising money for 10 years because it's a Constitution amendment. Why would we want to do that? Why can't we just make it one of our many sales tax laws that we have for X many years or something? The other comment I had was that with the farming issue, the Humane Society, the U.S. Humane Society, that's not the people that take care of the little animals here and do all the rescues. The Humane Society has one of its major goals is to really get rid of all animal agriculture. They should be all vegans and under that circumstance, but I'm just wondering, you know, how much of this is working towards phasing out animal agriculture. 2 points, the Constitution, why we're doing amendments, and the point about the Humane Society's big, big push in these out-of-state things.
Okay, Marty, thanks. Yeah, we'll talk those through. Thanks for calling today.
You're welcome. Bye.
So, let's start with she mentioned why we're doing the transportation tax instead of just doing it legislatively. That's actually a legal thing.
The Missouri Constitution is a lot more extensive in its reach and descriptions of what the powers and duties of and restrictions on state government are than the U.S. Constitution is to the United States government. We've actually had four constitutions in Missouri's history. The most recent was written in 1945. We have two sales taxes that are in the Constitution right now. One is for the Department of Conservation and one is for state parks and soils. If they had written a law that said, while this sales tax is in effect, no one can raise fuel taxes, well, it would have done no good because the next year the legislature could have repealed the portion that says you can't raise fuel taxes while this is in effect and then proposed a fuel tax. There are a lot of people who think we're cluttering up our Constitution with things. The opponents of Amendment 1 say that there is a statutory right to farm that's already in place. It says that if you move in next to a farm, you've got to put up with the dust that escapes at harvest time and the smells that are created by the cows who are in the corral. But Missouri's Constitution is much more lengthier, detailed, and probably overloaded with these kinds of things, but it gives the supporters of any particular issue an added protection from an opposition legislature.
Just to amplify what Rudy's saying, that's not unusual to Missouri's not unusual. Many state constitutions are broader, bigger, I should say, than the federal constitution. And that's sort of a system of our government. The federal constitution is supposed to be a broad framework. The other powers it doesn't have are supposed to be reserved to the states, and then the states spell those out in greater details in their constitutions, and it trickles down.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Amendment 7, for example, actually couldn't just be a legislative action, right? I mean, the legislature can't just raise taxes like that.
Well, the legislature can't raise a tax of that amount on its own. It would have to refer it to the ballot, but it could have referred it to the ballot as a mere statutory change. It didn't have to do as a constitutional amendment.
And it could have done a modest tax increase, say a tenth of a cent on sales tax, and not have gone to voters. A couple of pennies on the fuel tax, but that's about as far as the powers go. For the other caller's other point, the Humane Society of the United States, they have some people who are their supporters and who are their officials who have expressed a great deal of animosity to the way animal agriculture is done in the United States. However, I think that the vast majority of Americans are meat eaters. As Homer Simpson said, if we didn't want to eat pigs, God would not have put all three of the tastiest meats on the same animal. and so I think that the fear that the Humane Society of the United States will somehow prevail upon us all to become vegans is quite a bit in the future, if ever.
Right. We had a comment kind of echoing off of what you were talking about, Scott, when we talked about opposition to the transportation tax. Donna M. said, construction maintenance of roads and bridges should not be funded through a general sales tax, even if food's not included. Regressive sales taxes hurt the already disenfranchised. She says the fuel tax should be increased instead. And so, yeah, efforts for that haven't happened or have been successful
right.
in recent years.
Yeah, the opponents have been sounding that alarm throughout this whole campaign. The more fair way to do this would be to focus on the users, and they primarily call attention to the trucking industry, which would pay nothing extra other than if truckers buy a meal or mm-hmm. a candy bar on their way through the state. So I think the caller's thoughts resonate with a lot of folks out there. Mm-hmm. I do think it's worth noting for the listeners what Boone County projects are on this list should the thing pass or if that plays in their decision about how to vote on it. There's $20 million to take another crack at reconfiguring the intersection of I-70 and U.S. 63, which anybody who drives through there on a regular basis might think that needs attention. Whether this is the way to pay for it is another matter. $17.2 million to extend Stadium Boulevard from that nub out by what is now the domain up toward and connecting to Route WW. I won't list all these, but some of the bigger ones. $14 million for a new terminal. and runway improvements at Columbia Regional Airport. The city has a $17.1 million architectural there's a report from an architect that says $17.1 million would build you a new terminal out there. So the state would chip in $9 million toward that if this were to pass. Mm-hmm. $10.5 million to extend daily bus service by 2 hours. And then there are sidewalk projects in here for Columbia. And then, as David mentioned earlier, $1 million for Oates to establish a transportation service for seniors between Columbia and Jeff City.
The projects that Scott just mentioned are both a talking point for supporters and a talking point for opponents. Opponents say that there is no overarching vision that we're going to spend $6 billion over the next 10 years. The only big thing that we are supposed to get is I-70, three lanes, both directions, from Wentzville to Independence. Everything else is projects on that scale to a great extent, all the way down to a couple of $100,000 for a two blocks of sidewalk along Garth Avenue. The opponents say, well, that means that there's no overarching vision in this. The supporters say, well, look how we got this project list. We went to every community around the state. We went to every local planning agency, the regional planning commissions, the metropolitan planning councils, and we said, what's important to you? And so instead of the highway commission saying, we want $6 billion and here's what we're going to give you, which they tried in 1992 and found out that they didn't have enough money for what they promised, they're asking all the local agencies to say, what's important to your community? What do you need? And then they made the regional planning commissions get together, and all of the communities sat in a room, and they came up with a project list that fit the money that was available for their area.
Do we have any idea whether we think this will pass?
Well, I don't make predictions.
Sure.
Tax increases in general typically have a hard time in Missouri. Mm-hmm. The last time there was a transportation tax on the ballot, and it was a mixture of fuel and sales taxes, was 2002, I believe. It lost overwhelmingly, was defeated very solidly. Of course, that was only a decade or so removed from the 1992 plan that Rudy mentioned, where they promised more than they could deliver, and that was fresh on people's minds. I think the argument the transportation folks are making this time is that they've done a better job of delivering on what they promised in the past decade or so. It should be noted, the main reason they're pursuing the sales tax, I think, is the quantity of money it can generate. The size of the Department of Transportation's road and bridge budget has declined from about $1.3 billion a year down to a projected $325 million a year in 2017. And they say if they don't get more money, they're just not going to be able to do more stuff, right? And they're going to not be able to repair roads, they can't do new projects. And so to generate as much money as they think is necessary from a fuel tax would have to be pretty large.
We're going to take a quick break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the primary election tomorrow. Rudy Keller, Scott Swofford, and David Lieber in the studio with us. I'm Ryan Famuliner. We'll be right back after this short break.
Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today on Intersection, we're discussing with journalists what you'll be seeing on the primary election ballot tomorrow and talking about what you need to know before you vote. Joining us in studio, Rudy Keller is a state government and politics reporter with the Columbia Tribune. Scott Swofford is the city editor of the Columbia Missourian and a professor at the MU School of Journalism. And David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press working at the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson Studio. In studio today, we have all these guys, and we're going to take some more questions from you in the audience. Actually, right now, we have one from, John from Columbia. John, are you there? John, are you there?
Yes. Do you
okay.
hear me?
Yes, there you are. Yes, thanks for calling today.
Good afternoon. I have a question for your panel relating to Amendment 7, and it deals with the special interest favoritism. So, effective August 28th of 2012, gosh, less than 2 years ago, the legislature exempted all trucks licensed over 54,000 pounds from paying any sales tax. And Proposition 7 prohibits any increase in the truck fuel tax for the next 10 years. Is this merely a coincidence, or is this some slick trick on the part of the legislature to pander to the trucking lobby?
Okay, John, good question. Thanks a lot. Might be tough for our journalists to necessarily answer that because it's maybe hard to pin down anyway. But
I don't know if it's coincidence or pandering, but I will point out this, that 2012 law that exempted big trucks over 54,000 pounds from the sales tax is sort of part of a trend that the legislature has been doing of exempting what they consider to be a broad definition of manufacturing from sales taxes. And so materials that are used as inputs for final product outputs, they've been continually exempting from sales taxes, whether it's the electricity used to make your pizza or the power poles that are put up to transmit your electricity. Those are two examples of things they exempted this year. This falls into that trend. I didn't hear any discussion about it when this bill came around this year. And so there didn't seem to be much talk of, hey, we exempted them from a sales tax a couple years ago, and now we're raising the sales tax, and they won't have to pay. So anyway.
The Trucking Association is one of the minor contributors to the campaign fund to pass Amendment 7. The engineering, construction, and unions are the major contributors to this program. And to be fair to them, the lobbyists or the executive director of the Missouri Trucking Association told me that they wanted a fuel tax component to this. They're willing to pay more fuel taxes to get better roads, to safer roads, to speed their loads along the way. Many of their contracts are built with a fuel surcharge built in, so that means that when fuel prices do go up, they can pass that on to customers. The argument that is made for exempting the trucks and the same reason is that if the tax is on there, then it drives up the prices to the consumers because it increases the prices on the business. The sales tax was chosen purely and simply because polling showed that it was the most likely thing to pass. It had nothing to do with what is the most effective way to raise money. It had nothing to do with what is the fairest way to raise money. It was pure, and the supporters will tell you this all day long, it polled the best.
I would add, it polled the best, and it could generate a lot in one swoop.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Well, we probably better move on because there's a lot else to talk about. But staying in the vein of sales tax, Proposition EPIC here in Boone County is a 1/8-cent sales tax. Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, first of all, I would say kudos to the county for coming up with the most creative ballot proposition name I've ever seen. If there's a different one out there, I don't know. EPIC stands for Economic Parks and Parks and Investment in Community. So this sales tax would be 1/8 of 1%. It's been proposed by the Boone County Commission. And it's intended to address a long-standing challenge that the county has had since it bought what was then the Boone County Fairgrounds 15 years ago. Now they call it the Central Missouri Event Center, home of the Boone County Fairgrounds. And so the county, that's been a losing proposition for the county since it acquired that property. And they're trying to come up with a steady, sustainable revenue stream that will allow them to develop that property in a way that it can become a recreational resource and a real something that will have much more of a chance of attracting major events and that sort of thing. So this would generate about $2 to $3 million a year, $18 million up to about $18 million over the time it would be in effect. It would be set to expire in 2020. An interesting component of this is that they also, the county commission has said it would create a grant fund and contribute as much as $500,000 a year to that fund so that small towns like Roachport, Harrisburg, Hartsburg, on Hallsville, Ashland could tap into that money to do parks projects in their own towns. And we know that some of these smaller towns probably have a lot of trouble coming up with money to do those sorts of things. So, again, it's intended to address a long-standing problem with the management and development of that property. But you know, opponents have said, wait a minute, you're being awfully vague about exactly how you would spend that money. Now, there is a master plan that's been on file with county government for many years. Former Commissioner Skip Elkin helped put that together. It's my understanding that while that might serve as a baseline guide, they intend to come up with a new master plan for the fairground with public input and decide how they're going to spend that money. But there's also this this idea that we're also going to be able to spend some of this money on economic development projects, and the county commission has cited the roads that led to the new Battle High School as an example of an economic development project that this might be able to fund. So the opponents are saying that's a little mishy-mushy. You need to be a lot more specific about how you would spend that money. So also, the county has suggested that it might be interested in contract. If this were to pass, it might be interested in contracting with the city of Columbia to manage and develop that property. That might be a sticky wicket, though, because the city is unhappy with this tax because it has two of its own parks sales taxes, and it's really worried that this is going to push people over the limit in terms of sales tax in support of parks and what happens when we try to renew our own parks tax here in the fairly near future.
Sure. Yeah, and while we talked about how it's tough to get a tax passed at state level, local level, sometimes you have more success.
Yeah, sometimes you have more success, but the deal that has kind of been made for a long time in Missouri was that the schools would have property taxes, the local governments would have sales taxes, and the state would have income taxes. The state has a sales tax, 3% for general revenue, and another percent for schools, and a couple of small ones, parks and conservation, like I mentioned. But that rate, 4.225%, has been unchanged since the parks tax was approved in the 1980s. Local option sales taxes are what make your sales tax in Columbia the base rate, just a hair under 8%. Local districts like the Community Improvement District that is down here in downtown Columbia, or the Transportation Development Districts, of which there are 13 around Columbia, add a half of a percent to another percent on top of that. So once EPIC is passed, which is being sold as, well, it's only a quarter on $200 worth of purchases. Well, that quarter adds to the other dimes and nickels that are collected in sales tax, to the point where now the top sales tax rate in Columbia, if both of these measures pass, will just be a hair under 10%, which is a fairly, you know, and so whether that's a threshold level, and I talked about this deal that was kind of the unwritten deal. Well, Columbia is now thinking, and I think they're going to put a property tax increase on the November ballot, which is kind of encroaching on the schools' territory for taxation.
Right?
So the city is seeing that the sales tax has gotten to the point where it's an untenable issue for them to keep asking for something more if they want it. Now they're going to the property tax, and soon the schools may find that they can't get their bond issues passed if the property taxes get too high. So,
right. Well, we probably need to move on to some of because there's a lot of things on the ballot tomorrow we haven't gotten to yet. Maybe we'll run through some of those amendments very quickly that we hadn't talked about yet. Amendment 5, let's start with that one, the right to bear arms, what that is. And that's another one that it's not necessarily clear what it would do, right?
Well, of course, we're all familiar with the fact that we have the right to keep and bear arms already under the U.S. Constitution and under the Missouri Constitution. So what this amendment would do would enhance that right, you might say. It would add ammunition and firearms accessories to the list of arms that you have the right to keep and bear. It would subject gun control restrictions to a strict legal scrutiny, which means if there is some law or regulation passed that somehow tries to limit firearms, say the open carry of firearms or something like that, someone could challenge that under this constitutional provision and saying, hey, wait, I have a right to do this. It's subject to strict legal scrutiny. You can't do that. This is another case where there's we're not the first state. Louisiana passed something like this a couple years ago, and they've actually seen an explosion of lawsuits, primarily by criminal defendants who are now raising objections in their court proceedings to a variety of charges, alleging that they are infringing on their new constitutional right. I don't think that so far many of those people have been successful, but the Attorney General's office down there says they have spent a lot of time handling those cases.
Interesting. And that this is one that hasn't been quite not to the scale of Amendment 1 and Amendment 7 as much as – but are there still opponents and supporters that are really pushing this? Or it's one of those issues that people kind of know where they stand on it, I guess.
There's been virtually no money spent on this.
I am surprised it hasn't attracted a little bit more attention, though, just because it involves guns.
You know? Right. Typically, that plays pretty well in Missouri.
This was sponsored by our own state senator, Kurt Schaefer, who said it was necessary to bring the Missouri Constitution in line with recent U.S. Supreme Court rulings. But as David mentioned, there's this concern, particularly among prosecutors and law enforcement out there, that this might flip on its head that prohibition of felons owning or using firearms. I'm not smart enough to know whether that's actually going to be a factor, but there is a provision in the amendment that says it would still restrict the gun rights of convicted violent felons. Our own county prosecutor, Dan Nida, said, well, how do you define a violent felon? And he, too, is anticipating a lot of litigation over that particular
There is problem. Still the federal law that says no felon can own a firearm. Or be in possession of a firearm. The question then becomes, and there's a Missouri law that's similar, but the question becomes, well, will they want to refer every one of those cases to federal prosecutors, and will federal prosecutors want to deal with a large number of criminal cases? It often in drug cases where a felon has firearms, that does happen. It's transferred to the federal system, but I don't think that every time they find a felon with a firearm, are they going to want to send it to the federal prosecutor? It's an interesting thing. Most of the amendments are on the ballot, other than Amendment 1, are attempts to somehow define redefine or expand our rights. One of the other ones is Amendment 9.
Data privacy, electronic data privacy.
Yeah, and that really is once again, that's just a simple language that says that the people shall be secure in their persons, papers, homes, and effects, and that's the current law, and electronic communications and data. This was an interesting addition to the law and expansion of the law until the United States Supreme Court recently said that, yes, the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizure extends to your cell phone and to your other electronic communication, much like it would to a letter that you received in your mailbox that is not supposed to be opened by a law enforcement agent without a search warrant.
Right. By the time that Supreme Court decision came down, this had already been placed on the ballot. Some might say the U.S. Supreme Court really makes this moot, but I think the supporters would say it's better safe than sorry to have it in our own Constitution as well.
Sure.
Then there's Amendment 8.
I would say Amendment 8 is one that seems a little bit more obscure, right? It's this veterans lottery ticket. If you're not familiar with the issue, it might seem kind of strange if you're walking into the ballot box to see this one.
Well, right now when you buy a lottery ticket, All of those revenues that aren't used for prizes or for administration go to education, either elementary, secondary, or higher education. This would change that by creating a new lottery game, the proceeds of which would go to veterans' nursing homes and cemeteries. So the argument on either side of this was we need to do something to help these veterans' nursing homes. We're having more people come in there. There's a big waiting list. They need a dedicated funding stream, and this has been done in a few other states, so they went for it. There's some thought amongst the education community that you won't necessarily drive new people to buy lottery tickets, but it's the same people, and therefore they'll split some of their money between education and veterans tickets, and there might be a little less money going to schools.
And some people, though, would like to see a more steady flow of funds for veterans as well, right? That's another thing.
Right. It used to be $29 million in general revenue that was used for this, but the legislature cut it.
Right. But right now, the money that is collected from casinos for the admissions goes to this fund after the administration of the State Gaming Commission. However, admissions to casinos are down as well. The most recent figures I saw, for example, at Isle of Capri at Boonville was down about 10% in total admissions in the past year. So, and that's a continuing trend. That's nothing that is brand new, and it's nothing that happened immediately after the recession that we're rebounding from. It's been just a continuous steady drop-off in the number of people going to casinos in Missouri.
So what you see is a commonality of a lot of groups trying to find a dedicated funding stream. You know, the nursing homes for the veterans thought they had one until casino revenue started going down. In this sense, they're looking for another dedicated revenue stream, just like transportation is looking for a dedicated revenue stream, or just like the Boone County Fairgrounds thing is looking for its own dedicated revenue stream. When you don't have a dedicated source of money, you're open to the whims of budget cuts, and that's why everyone's trying to fortify themselves.
Hey, to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner. The primary election is tomorrow, and there are five state constitutional amendments on the ballot in addition to the regular races for nominations and other local issues. Today on Intersection, we're discussing with journalists what you'll be seeing on the ballot tomorrow and talking about what you need to know before you vote. Joining us in studio, Rudy Keller is a state government and politics reporter with the Columbia Tribune. Scott Swofford is the city editor of the Columbia Missourian and a professor at the MU School of Journalism. And David Lieb is a reporter with the Associated Press working at the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. For you and our audience, what questions do you have for our panelists today? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. There was one question from email that I wanted to bring in real quick. It related back to Amendment 7 we were talking about earlier. They're wondering if the sales tax revenue would also add to the trigger of the tax cut that the legislature just passed. I don't know if we know the answer to that or not, but the tax cut that was passed has a trigger. There has to be like, what, $150 million increase each year?
The answer would be no, because it's two different revenue streams. The income tax cut trigger is dependent on a rise in state general revenues. This would not flow into state general revenues. It would be a dedicated source of money straight to the transportation department. So two separate pools of money.
Okay.
It's a very good question.
Yeah, it was a good question. You know what? We've talked a lot, and we haven't – the fact is this is a primary election. We haven't talked about any of the primaries yet. We probably should do that with about 10 minutes left in the show. First, maybe let's start locally. Is there anything interesting locally in primary races?
Well, we have a couple of pretty interesting primaries going on at the county level. We have five people who are running to replace longstanding Associate Circuit Judge Larry Bryson in the 5th District of the 13th Judicial Circuit. We have three Democrats and two Republicans. The Democrats are Rob Fleming, Finley Gibbs, and Kim Shaw. All these folks have pretty impressive credentials. They have long legal backgrounds. Kim Shaw ran against Judge Bryson last time he was up for re-election and actually made it a pretty close race. I don't know if we have time for me to give boilerplate descriptions of their resumes or not, but all of them have longstanding legal experience. Mr. Fleming is an assistant prosecutor up in the 14th Judicial Circuit in Moberly. He's formerly been a public defender. He's worked for the Missouri State Tax Commission. He is campaigning on the fact that he has experience as both a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and says he makes that makes him unique among the candidates. Mr. Gibbs is a partner at the Rotz and Gibbs Law Firm. He's been there since 1997. He's worked on criminal cases, family law cases, traffic matters, personal injury, that sort of thing. And then Kim Shaw also, she's an assistant public defender now and was also served in that role in Cape Girardeau. She did some time in private practice before she came back to the public defender system. And again, she challenged Judge Bryson 4 years ago and came pretty close to unseating him. And then in a Republican, on the Republican ticket, you have Michael Whitlow. He's an attorney at the firm of Ford, Parshall, and Baker. Used to be an assistant attorney general. He's been in private practice focusing on criminal and family law since 91. Then you have Doug Scholl, who has his own private practice here in Columbia. He has not been campaigning very actively, so it looks like Mr. Whitlow has the edge in the Republican side of that race.
Another race we have for the 47th District, we have a Republican primary to run against Democrat incumbent John Wright.
Yeah, you have Betsy Phillips and Chuck Basie out there. I might defer to Rudy.
I think, Rudy, you've covered
because
this
because he's
race.
Covered that quite a bit more than I
it's,
have.
It's an interesting race. You have Chuck Basie is retired after 30 years with the Federal Aviation Administration, an air traffic controller, worked at the Flight Service Center out at Columbia Regional Airport for many of those years. Excuse me. Betsy Phillips is 76, and she's got an experience that you would think that after a lifetime of what she's done, she might be more interested in resting and playing with her grandchildren. She's volunteered with Christian groups in Africa to build summer camps for youth. She volunteered as a English teacher in China. She's got a degree as a chemist. Her husband was an engineer. And both of them are running very grassroots campaigns. They're not spending thousands of dollars trying to convince all the voters in the region that they're the best candidate. They've got about 2,200 voters they're targeting in Northwest Boone County, including City of Columbia, Cooper County, Howard County, and Randolph County. And they're going to take on an incumbent who won a narrow victory, but who has John Wright has substantial personal wealth, has worked hard to make himself known in his district, and is viewed by Democrats statewide as a potential attractive candidate for them. It's one of a number of races that Republicans would like to pick up to pad their majorities. There's also another dynamic, and I'm going to ask David to. I mean, what do you think? Are there any House races that you're watching because of internal Republican politics?
Well, let me just give you the overview first about the primaries. So there are fewer than 50 primaries that are contested going on tomorrow for state legislative seats. That means only one fourth actually have contested primaries. It's a pretty low number. Mm. And there are some primaries in various parts of the states where you have Republican incumbents being challenged in primaries. Some of those are cases where the Republican incumbent voted not to override the governor's veto of a tax cut last year, and so their primary challenger is being funded by groups that wanted that veto override to occur.
Pretty substantially funded.
Substantially funded. Money that has come from Missouri Club for Growth, perhaps through Rex Singfield, contributes to that group. Another thing that's important to note about tomorrow that really has a more immediate effect are there are three special elections. None are here in the Boone County area. One's over in St. Louis County, but the two to watch are Republican ones down near Rolla, just a little east of Rolla, and then down in southeast Missouri in Stoddard County, I think it is. If Republicans just win one of those three, and they're expected to win two, they regain a two-thirds majority in the House. Those people are likely to be sworn in by September 10th when the veto session occurs, and that means Republicans have new powers to override the governor's vetoes. It takes a two-thirds vote. They'll have two-thirds of their own members, meaning they won't have to rely on Democrats if they can all stick together to override vetoes. And so from my perspective, that's a more immediate thing to watch about what goes on tomorrow. than some of the primaries themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think our signal barely stretches to Rolla, so those people may have a chance to vote on that. But regardless, as you're saying, I mean, it could make a difference because there are a lot of vetoes that will be brought up that could be overridden.
The governor vetoed 32 bills that they'll be considering in September, plus about 136 or so line item budget vetoes. So there's a lot on the agenda.
Right, right. Another primary race we hadn't talked about yet here quickly, with a few minutes left. In District 4, U.S. Representative Vicki Hartzler does have a challenger in a Republican primary, John Webb, if that's right. I don't know. Do we know a lot about him?
I don't know that we know a whole lot about him. The Missourian has interviewed him. He calls himself a constitutional fiscal conservative. He says Ms. Hartzler has not been nearly conservative enough for the constituents around the 4th district that he's talked to. Like Representative Hartzler, he's from Cass County. He's a former police officer, served in the Kansas City Police Department for about 12 years back in the 70s and 80s. I guess he, as conservative as you might believe Representative Hartzler is, John Webb says he'll be even more conservative.
Yeah. I saw David's eyes kind of lighten up when you said, yeah.
Yeah, right. That's usually what you see in primaries, right? If you're a Republican, you want to run to the right. If you're a Democrat, you want to run to the left. And so even if someone has a reputation of being conservative, you're likely to get a challenge from someone who thinks they can be more conservative.
Right. Well, and that's kind of interesting given the fact that now Boone County is part of that district, right? Because that's not necessarily going to play too well in Boone County.
Yeah, the only county Vicki Hartzler lost in the 2012 campaign was Boone. When they redrew the congressional boundaries, Boone County became part of the 4th district, and it was interesting to see that because we knew that Boone County was getting lumped in with what was otherwise a very conservative or rural type of district.
Well, Boone County, Rudy. Members of Congress, Democratic or Republican, have always not wanted Boone County to be part of their district because we tend to vote against whoever is in office. In the 1970s, we were connected to a district that ran all the way to the Arkansas border. In the 1980s and 90s, we were connected to a district that ran all the way into northeast Missouri to the Mississippi River and the Iowa line. Now we're connected with a district that runs along the Missouri River, southward through the Lake of the Ozarks region, all the way to the Kansas border. So there's not enough population here to make a district that's centered on Boone County, and we vote differently than most of the rest of rural Missouri, that whoever represents us probably would rather not represent us.
Well, we also need to mention that there's a Libertarian primary in the 4th Congressional District between Herschel Young, who also ran 2 years ago, and Randy Lancrer. At the Missourian, we haven't had any luck reaching Mr. Lancrer. He lives in Warrensburg. He owns and operates some small businesses over there. He's a bookkeeper. He's chosen not to engage with us. But Herschel Young is from Harrisonville. Again, he ran 2 years ago. He's a Cass County native, veteran of the U.S. Army, and he says he wants to reduce the tax burden on U.S. citizens. So good luck with that.
Well, we'll have to end it there. That's all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guest, Rudy Keller, the state government and politics reporter with the Columbia Tribune, Scott Swofford, the city editor of the Columbia Missourian and a professor at the MU School of Journalism, and David Lieb, a reporter with the Associated Press working at the Missouri State Capitol in Jefferson City. Intersection's produced by Janet Saidi and Maureen Lewis-Stump. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Hope Kerwin and Austin Federa. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.